now, the three teachers' conferences are in session this week, a range of topics being discussed, but primary among them would seem to be the cost of living crisis, which of course is attracting everybody else's attention in the country. Already the INTO has set out its stall with its president Joe McKeown yesterday in his address telling delegates at the opening of their conference that a planned 1% pay rise under the existing public sector pay deal is nowhere near enough. A survey emerged from the Teachers Union of Ireland yesterday regarding the prospects of teachers who don't see themselves a decade down the road as still in the profession. Let's find out more what's exercising the attention of teachers, not to mention, of course, a huge influx of thousands of Ukrainian students who will be returning to school after the Easter holidays. I'm joined by the General Secretary of the Teachers Union of Ireland, Michael Gillespie. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Ken.
And thank you for joining us. Your conference is in Cork, I believe, this week.
No, no, ours is in Wexford.
You're in Wexford. Wexford. Yes. The STI is in Cork, and the INTO is in Killarney. Right,
correct.
Got that. Right, the cost of living crisis, is it all about money from your perspective, Michael? And echoing what the INTO are saying, that 1% is just not enough. We need to revisit the whole public sector pay deal.
Well, I suppose what we're seeing now is very unusual. We're seeing supply-led inflation, which we haven't seen for decades. So what's affecting our members is the cost of energy, the cost of fuel, the cost of even food going up because of, you know, a whole mix of things now in society. So these are things that people can't afford to avoid. It's not like demand led where you can give up something. So people need money to do this. Obviously, we've got a very young teaching profession. A lot of them have moved down into Kildare, who are teaching in Dublin, because they couldn't afford the rents in Dublin. Now they find they can't afford to put fuel in their cars to actually go to work. And this is partly due to something you mentioned earlier, which is the idea of the pay discrimination. The people who came in post-2011 who are on a different pay scale than I was on when I was a teacher, you know, pre-2011. So they're doubly disadvantaged. On top of that then, unlike, let's say, national school teachers who get their first jobs are teaching a class, so they're full-time, whole-time jobs. Teachers in post-primary, their first job or two is teaching hours because they're teaching subjects. So they don't even start. So the average age of a teacher in post-primary getting a full-time job is 26. That puts them very far behind everybody else, and that's why our survey said that 73% of those appointed after 2011 don't believe they'll be able to buy a house. In other words, they won't be able to get a mortgage even.
But that, Michael, is something, given the way prices are rampant in the housing market, that's something that can't simply be addressed by, you know, constantly giving pay rises right across the public sector, which ultimately are funded partly by the private sector as well. And the fact that secondary teachers, I understand, are due to get a 1,300 a year pay increase anyway, following a decision to restore allowances that were cut during the recession.
Now, just to be clear on that, the state isn't paying for that. Teachers are paying for that. We were due a 1% pay rise in February. All teachers were post-primary teachers. The TUI and the ASDI, in fairness, have decided to forego that 1% to give back the allowance that was taken away from new entrants in 2011. So that's not costing the state anything. We're paying for it. We're solving a problem that previous political parties, all which agreed it was wrong but still did it, we're solving the problem for our members ourselves. It's coming out of our pockets, our 1%. We want to go further. We want to actually, teachers coming in from next year, to get more people into the profession, we want to start them on the third point of the scale, like pre-2011 people did. They started on the third point of the scale because we've got a six-year, it takes 6 years to qualify, 4 years to do a degree and 2 years to do a PME. And again, who's paying for that? We're prepared to pay for that. That's coming out of our 1%. But we've got no answer yet from DEEPER to say whether we can do this. So we're prepared to use our own money, forego our own pay increase, to bring our new entries, our colleagues, sometimes our sons, our daughters, our nieces, our nephews, up to the same pay that we enjoy, which is, as you said earlier, is also struggling to meet the challenges of inflation. But if we don't look after the people who are coming behind us, then what are we? We're not teachers then.
You will understand, Michael, and I say this with the greatest of respect, that people out there, you know, will say, have a jaundiced view and say, teaching not attractive. How could it not be attractive? You have a permanent job. You have a very, very favourable pension scheme that receives huge subvention from the government, unlike people who would have to pay into a pension in the private sector. It's a job for life, and there's those fabled, you know, 22-hour weeks and 6 months holidays in the year. You know what I'm talking about there now?
No, I mean, look, teaching...
How could it not be attractive?
Well, look at it this way. The vast majority, 30% of those employed after, believe they won't be in teaching after 10 years. The bureaucracy that's becoming associated with teaching is so great. People are leaving it. They have transferable skills. They're going to the multinationals. And that's why we have scarcities of, and we've spoken about this before, Clem, of Spanish teachers, German teachers, science teachers, even teachers in the practical areas, because they're going other places, because they are better paid. They are getting... And they're also getting share options and things. So teaching is not as attractive as it used to be. This golden handshake of a pension, you know, the post-2013 people have a pension scheme that, you know, it's 35% worse than the pension scheme I'm in as a teacher. And it's coordinated with the old age pension. They're not going to be rich on it. And all those pensions are based on people owning their own house. Okay. These people will not own their own house. They will not have a great pension when they retire. And they're paying a large amount for it. So the days of the pension being something that kept teachers in the job is gone, I'm afraid.
There is one other element, of course, and I don't want to flog this. I'll move on because there are other topics that are of great importance to you as well. There is the fact that any public servant retiring from a job gets 1.5 times their annual salary as well if they have served the required 30, 35, 40 years or whatever else. So it's a perk that very few, if any, in the private sector get that. Now, before we move on, just one final point to make, Michael, in that is, economists will say throwing money at a problem in the way of price of salary increases is not a way to address the spiralling inflation. In fact, it will only contribute to it. Maybe a better way is to address the taxation system.
Well, that's if you have, we'll say, demand-led inflation. Okay, there's more controls you can put in. This is supply-led inflation. People cannot avoid buying fuel to heat their houses. They cannot afford. They have to buy fuel for their cars to go to work. They have to buy food. These are the things that have been going up dramatically in the last couple of months. So you can't avoid them. So we need to give people the money just to live now.
All right. Okay, moving on to other topics. Senior cycle reform. I know that's exercising the two post-primary unions. Yourself, you were quoted in an article in the Irish Times over the weekend. Fairness for all students and the significant public trust that the current system enjoys cannot be put at risk. The nub of this is proposals that would see teachers responsible for marking up to 40% of their own students' work. You are professionals. You're very highly regarded within Irish society in terms of your contribution to the education of generations of people. Do you not trust the professionalism of your own members to mark your own papers?
No. What we're looking to protect is the relationship with our students. So, for example, and this is again, I have to remind people, 27 of the 41 subjects at Leaving Cert already have second or third components of assessment. These are orals, day practicals, project work, portfolios, the music performance exams. Some are worth more than 40%. They're worth 50 and 70%. These are held in high esteem at the moment because they are marked by teachers, but teachers employed by the State Exams Commission to do it. So you're not marking your own students. You go to another school. This maintains the relationship between you and your own students. Now, I've heard people say, oh, but what about international standards? Our international standards would make some people's eyes water. 94% of students, unheard of in most jurisdictions, stay in school until they do their Leaving Cert, or the Leaving Cert Applied, or LCVP, one of the programs. We have the third highest participation at senior cycle. Now, that doesn't happen by accident. To me, that's happening because of the relationship in schools between teachers and students and parents and teachers. As you said, they're very, very trusted. We have a brand that is the Leaving Cert that absolutely needs to be changed. We accept that. We believe that there should be second and third components of assessment. The TUI is fully supportive of them, and they can be spread over the 2 years. But we believe that they should be done by the State Exams Commission. We saw what grade inflation did over the last 2 years. So the State Exams Commission has a proven track record in maintaining standards and maintaining a Leaving Cert that travels everywhere in the world.
All right, you referred to the bureaucratic workload, which you'll be addressing those issues. You've referred to that during the chat we've heard. There's issues around crowded classrooms, teacher shortages, which you've talked about, poorly ventilated schools, with news of another variant about to become prevalent in Ireland. We all need to up our precautions again in relation to that. But one other aspect, and Michael, thank you for joining us, because I know how busy you are with the conference underway. Ukrainian pupils, all the unions, INTO, ASTI and your own TUI are warning about the education system coming under significant strain unless more teacher supports are made available. We're talking about possible thousands of Ukrainian students returning to our Irish schools after the Easter break. Not alone problems with resources in terms of actual physical resources like teachers in place, but the whole language issue and other stuff.
Yeah, and even capacity of space. I mean, the second level system was already under pressure because of the demographic increase. I mean, we know that students in primary schools who are moving into secondary school are increasing over the next couple of years. Peak second level is until 2026. So there was always going to be a capacity issue. We have schools all over the country that are oversubscribed, second level schools. Now we're the Ukrainians, and they're more than welcome. Our country, you know, is doing very well, giving them sanctuary. But the numbers that are coming in, you know, are very, very big. We more than likely can get to June with the numbers that are present. But then if the same numbers are coming, you know, 500 or 600 people a day over the summer months, then how are we going to deal with it in September?
And I don't have to tell you, Michael Gillespie, it's no good just bringing in X number of Ukrainian students into a school or into a classroom and letting them sit there. Because yes, aside from language difficulties and stuff like that, many of these kids are coming with possible psychological problems and yes, traumatised.
The longer this goes on, the more traumatised or the more things we'll have witnessed that I'd say me or you would not want to even witness, that they're going to be coming into the country. You know, the people who came in the first couple of weeks were more than likely travelling when it was starting. They left early, but we're going to see more and more of that. So we need supports into our schools. We need, you know, even teachers, you know, you're talking about the teacher contact time. You know, years ago we had a very heavy pastoral care system in schools, which depended on post and responsibility. That still hasn't been brought back to the levels it was at 2008. Now we are back with career guidance, but the career guidance and counselling services will be swamped in schools, as will the NEPS service, you know, psychological services, with the sheer numbers that are going to come in. So we need a contingency plan, a plan in place by June for what's going to happen next September. Okay. We can't be fiddling around with this in September when the students are actually here after coming in over the summer months.
Oh, lots of challenges then ahead for schools, as if they didn't have enough of them already. Yes, indeed, thousands of Ukrainian students. And those other issues that Michael Gillespie, General Secretary of the Teachers Union of Ireland, is telling us about, his conference will be addressing, as well as the INTO and the ASTI conferences as well. Michael Gillespie, thank you very much for that. Now, ADHD, what is it? Well, you're about to find out a little bit more, maybe a lot more, hopefully. Additional supports for adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder have been announced by Minister of State for Mental Health Mary Butler. We often hear ADHD in the context of children, but not very often indeed. Rarely do we hear it in the context of adults. Ken Kilbride is CEO of ADHD Ireland. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Hi, how are you? Well,
thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. I suppose, in a nutshell, explain to listeners, what is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
So the letters stand for ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And so it's a condition that affects, you know, 5% of children and probably about 3.5% of adults. So there's three main behaviours associated with the condition, and they're sort of the attention deficit. Now, that's a misnomer in that, you know, people with ADHD can focus as well as anyone else. It's just the inability to retain attention is a difficulty. There's the impulsivity, which is, you know, simply, I have to say it and I have to say it now. And then there's the hyperactivity, which is being on the go and driven by a motor. So when you get all those three together, and they become an impairment in your life, well, then you can get a diagnosis of ADHD.
And how serious an impairment is it? Let's start with children.
So in terms of children, what you do find is, you know, there is still that perception out there that it's, you know, 10-year-old boys bouncing off the walls. So what you find is that, you know, the hyperactivity tends to get picked up and seen first, but it's a very genetic condition. So what you find is there's 50% boys, 50% girls. And then what you find is that, you know, in terms of the research, and they did some research in the UK, they did 46,000 children, and they gave them individual scores at the start of primary school for attention deficit, for impulsivity and hyperactivity. And what they found is, you know, the hyperactivity had no effect on learning. Impulsivity was actually positively associated, because they had the willing to have a go. It was the attention deficit that was producing low scores in sort of English and maths. So for children, it can be a learning difficulty when it's not picked up.
And much misunderstood over the decades, because ADHD, which is now a recognised condition, in the past would have been designated as that jack-in-the-box child down in the corner that's jumping up and down, never paying attention. For God's sake, will you cop on and listen to what I'm saying, etc., etc., etc.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You know, we always say it's the multi-child syndrome is what it used to be called. You know, and there's things like that, and one of the, we always say the biggest difficulty with ADHD is not having ADHD itself. It's the low self-esteem and the stigma that goes with the condition. They're the ones that tend to drive the difficulties, you know, particularly for adolescents and as they move into adulthood.
Because whether it's attention deficit or impulsivity, as you mentioned there, or whatever aspect of it, the individual has no particular control over the condition.
Well, that's it, you know. What we're talking about there is something called emotional regulation. And, you know, if you imagine, the, you know, something like Dublin Airport and the air traffic control. So the air traffic control is there and say, you know, we want this plane to land, this plane to take off, you go around the back. There's someone there, you know, regulating everything. For someone with ADHD, they don't have that. So when the thought comes into the mind, you know, would it be good, bad or indifferent, there's nothing there to say, we'll think about it first before we do it, or the action. So they just go and do it.
Right. Minister of State Mary Butler, she's announced, it emerged yesterday, that a recruitment process has begun for the special teams, which will be based in community healthcare organisations. Four of them in Cork, Kerry, but there will be seven for Kildare, West Wicklow, Dublin West, South City and South West, and eight teams in Laois, Offaly, Longford, Westmeath, Louth and Meath. Now, the only thing is, while the numbers look good as seven for Kildare, West Wicklow, Dublin West, South City and South West, that's some spread geographically to put seven new teams into. How big an impact do you think? Because we're talking about here now, and not ADHD teams to deal with children, but of course, while we associate the condition with children, it doesn't just go away the day you have your 18th birthday.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And, you know, just for instance, we would have published some research last week which showed that, you know, 20% of adults with ADHD had attempted suicide in their past lives. 50% have had self-harm. 10% consider suicide as an option going forward. We know that adults with unmanaged, untreated ADHD will have higher rates of conditions such as anxiety and depression, higher rates of substance misuse around alcohol primarily. They can have lower life expectancy. So it's a very serious condition. When you look at, you know, nationally, there's probably about, you know, approximately 150,000 adults in Ireland with ADHD today. And, you know, in Kildare, you're looking at about 66,000. So there is an awful lot of adults out there in the region. Now, the plan is not to get everybody done on day one, but over a period of time, as people come forward to get the assessment, that the teams are there in place to give the right treatment.
Just back to what I was saying there a minute ago, you know, seven teams for Kildare, West Wicklow, Dublin West, Dublin South City and Dublin South West. It's a huge geographical spread. How confident are you about the improvement that this will bring about in dealing with ADHD amongst adults?
One of the things we're very confident about is, and, you know, this is things we always say.
You know, waiting lists are over a year long as it is.
Oh, God, yeah. Is that, you know, once you do get assessed and get the right treatment, now I do need to preface the words right treatment, life outcomes generally improve. It's one of those conditions that's actually very, very manageable. So again, having the services there are really, really important. So we're now going from a situation where there isn't any services to hopefully services that will be coming online. Now, there is a small caveat there, and that, you know, this applies to Kildare as much as anywhere around the country, is that, you know, there is a lack of psychiatrists out there, and there is challenges recruiting people into the system to run these services. So hopefully, I mean, that's going to be the big challenge for the HSE between now and end of the year. is getting the, you know, particularly the psychiatrists in to run the service. But once they do that, people can get in. You know, it should improve people's lives.
All right. Minister Butler also confirmed that the National Clinical Programme for ADHD, along with ADHD Ireland, of which Ken is the CEO, and the UCD School of Psychiatry, is to launch a new ADHD app to provide information and support for adults who have the condition or think they might have. Those are staggering numbers that are quoted by Ken there. 160,000 people, or 3.4% of the adult population, estimated to have the disorder, and I think he mentioned there 60,000 plus in County Kildare. A condition long unrecognised. It's just been giddiness or not bothered paying attention or whatever else, or low self, whatever else. Anyway, it is a recognised disorder now, and the news of those new teams, seven of them for the Kildare, West Wicklow, Dublin area to be announced, will be very welcome indeed. Ken Kilbride, CEO of ADHD Ireland, thank you for joining us, Ken, this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
By the way, any prospect of when that app might be in place and ready to download or anything?
In terms of the app, it's currently being built. You know, we've gone through what's called the beta testing. It's currently out with the adult teams in HSE for, you know, just having a look at. Once we do that, we'll take it back to ADHD Ireland. We'll get some adults to test drive it, basically. And then sort of 2 weeks after that, so hopefully in the next 2 or 3 months.
All right, that's good. That's a reasonable short timeline then, and we'll keep an eye on that and maybe touch base with you again. Meanwhile, CEO of ADHD Ireland, Ken Kilbride, thanks for joining us, Ken. I think people will have a much better understanding now of a condition that's often in the past been dismissed. Thanks for joining us in Kildare Today. Have a good week.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, Clem, would you find out if it's council land that the travellers pulled into in Salins? They're arriving there in convoy. I counted them this morning, says a listener. There are 30 caravans. The place is a mess, and locals have been attacked by dogs when walking, allegedly, where they're pulled in. Oh, and you're a resident of that fine village or town, or whatever. You and I were chatting about this on Friday.
Yeah. And I was talking to residents over the weekend as well about this. So it's just on the New Salins bypass Link Road where they've pulled in, essentially nearly under the bridge, and there would be about 30 of them, caravans and, you know, vans and cars in there. Now, over the weekend, I got in touch with Carmel Kelly, who's a local Fianna Fáil councillor in the Salins area, just to ask her, was she aware of the traveller encampment that listeners have been in touch? She said that she was aware that the Gardaí, Kildare County Council, the National Roads Office and the Dog Warden have all been notified since last week. And I asked Carmel if she could perhaps come on the programme tomorrow to discuss that. She was away for the last few days, so just waiting for her to come back to us. But
is it council land?
I couldn't be sure.
Or is it Transport Ireland, the highway?
See, you have to remember that before the Link Road was built, this was just fields.
I know, but if there's a Link Road there now, who built the Link Road? Is it Transport Ireland? Would be possibly, but there must be. What are the Gardaí? Is it causing a serious obstruction?
Yeah, it wouldn't be obstruction, no. It's in off the road. But, you know, I've heard of incidents where residents have allegedly been attacked by the dogs, you know, where the people are coming out of the encampment and causing hassle going into shops, etc., etc. So, you know, there is a bit of concern within the village.
All right.
And as Carmel said, look, she's been on to the guards, the council and the National Roads Office. So we'll just have to wait and see what comes from that.
All right, take it away.
Yeah, we'll stay in the Naas Municipal District. And Evie Salmon is a Fine Gael councillor. She's based in Ballymore. Good morning to you, Evie.
Good morning, Owen. How are you?
I'm good. Let's first of all go to a motion that you brought forward to the recent meeting. You wanted the council to install shared space signs on all roads identified as walking routes in the Naas Municipal District.
Yes, so we have walking routes identified in our speed limit review. And these walking routes, you know, they'd be the likes of the Chipper Road, the Craddockstown Road, roads in Eadstown, Ballymore, Eustace, Salins, Naas. They all get to an amenity. So the likes of the Chipper Road, people walking out to the rugby club, the likes of the Craddockstown Road, people walking out to Punches Town. And what I want to see is the likes of a shared space sign going up saying this road is a walking route, and letting people know, letting drivers know that there will be pedestrians and that there may be an increase in cyclists. So I've been told that the lower speed limit is needed where these pedestrian signs go. So they are, that's the speed limit of 30 or 20 kilometres an hour. But I am going to pursue it through the speed limit review and push for signage through that.
Okay.
Because I think it's fair to give a warning to drivers and pedestrians that it is a shared space. And it's also something that would work well along our canals and greenways when they come forward as well.
Okay, Evie, if you just go back to the issue then in Salins, do you know if that road is council land or if it's, you know, Transport Infrastructure Ireland?
I'm not sure if it's been passed over to the council yet. It would be between the two, and I know everyone has been notified, so I know Gardaí are dealing with any antisocial behaviour, and KCC are aware of the issue as well, and the National Transport Authority. So I don't have an answer yet, Owen, but I would imagine it's between the two. The two entities there.
Okay, you had another motion then as well wanting the council to outline the number of unauthorised developments currently being investigated within the NACEMD.
Yeah, so look, this is always a difficult one to deal with, and it's usually out of frustration from other people who have complied with planning permission, usually being restricted, and then someone builds something beside them or behind them or around them that's unauthorised. And look, you can see from the numbers, in 2021 we had 268 new cases. There was 434 warning letters issued, only 81 enforcement notices off the back of those warning letters. And, you know, our breakdown that we get doesn't tell us whether those warning letters worked or whether enforcement just hasn't been, you know, enforcement notices haven't been served. 10 have gone to legal proceedings. And 150 files have been closed. And again, we don't know with those files closing whether it's a positive outcome for the council or a positive outcome for the person building the unauthorised development. So look, you know, these have been dragging on for years, and it's just something that we want to get on top of in the council. And they vary from so many different issues, and we're not really dealing just with someone putting on an extension. We're dealing with full-blown industrial-sized buildings being unauthorised, and it's just not fair on people who have complied with planning, and then they have something towering over them that never had to come through the council. So look, it's something I'm going to continue working on, and I'd love to see those numbers reduced.
Okay, with those motions and issues brought forward to the recent Nace Municipal District meeting, that is Fine Gael Councillor Evie Salmon. Thanks, Evie.
Thanks indeed, Owen. Thank you, Evie, for that. Now, moving along, Kildare County Council, or Kildare Library Service Decade of Commemorations Committee, has compiled and published a wonderful, wonderful wall poster, or indeed just something that you can carry around with you in regards to the Civil War here in County Kildare. Frank Aiken, in August 1922, said, "War with the foreigner brings to the fore all that is best and noblest in a nation. Civil war brings out all that is mean and base." The opening quotation on this poster. Frank Aiken, who was to succeed General Liam Lynch, who was killed during the Civil War as the chief of the anti-treaty side in the Civil War, was later to become a Fianna Fáil minister and in fact deputy leader of Fianna Fáil. I'm joined by one of the compilers and contributors to this programme, local historian James Durney. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Sam.
Thank you for joining us. And first of all, well done to you, to Mario Corrigan, Carl Kiley and Kevin Murphy on the compilation of this very fine poster with photographs and everything else. And it's free in local libraries right around the county. Right, we know that Dáil Éireann approved the Anglo-Irish Treaty, the poster tells us, by 64 votes to 57 on January 7th, 1922. And on February the 1st, James, the National Army troops, or the pro-treatyites as we would call them, essentially, from Selbridge Barracks, took possession of Beggar's Bush Barracks in Dublin, the first British Army barracks to be handed over.
Yeah, well, this was the former Selbridge Workhouse and had been turned into a training camp and then a barracks for the new National Army. And they were outfitted there in Selbridge before they marched up to Dublin and took over Beggars Bush Barracks, as it says. And that photograph, as you see in the poster, was donated by the caretaker of Selbridge Library years ago, and it was a photograph of that his father had, and there's a picture of his father on the top right hand corner then as well. Yes. And all these photographs, most of these photographs were donated to us or myself through research by relatives of people involved.
And I have to say, the photographs are fantastic. Just moving through as we are, because this is a snapshot, people can read each significant date over the period from the signing of the treaty to the end of the Civil War on a month-by-month basis through 1922, 1923. For example, we see that on the 24th of March, 22, Naas Police Barracks, the county RIC headquarters, was evacuated, as well as the barracks of Maynooth and Kildare. Now, there were army conventions held. Tension is rising because on the 27th of March, the delegates representing 49 brigades of the IRA, the anti-IRA, formed an executive council, those opposed to the treaty. And then on the 14th of April, things were ratcheted up significantly, James, because Rory O'Connor of the anti-treatyites, they took over the forecourts.
Yeah, just the day before the Civic Guard arrived in Kildare Artillery Barracks to take over as the new police force.
Which was commemorated on Saturday last.
Commemorated on Saturday. And then you had that great Leinster rally in Naas outside what was then the Hibernian Bank, with Michael Collins as the principal speaker, and many local dignitaries, local politicians and that on the platform as well, all pushing for the passing of the treaty. And if you look at that photograph underneath it, then in May, it was taken under Curra Camp. And Michael Collins is, if you're looking at it, second left. Emmett Dalton then beside him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no date in that photograph, but it's the summer of 1922. Could have been when he'd arrived as a deputation to have a look at the Curra Camp and that. He also arrives in August 1922 when he's on his trip south, before he gets killed.
He was killed on the 22nd of August. He was commander-in-chief of what was called the National Army. The pro-treatyites, if you like, was killed in an ambush at Ballinan Law, County Cork. Richard Mulcahy taking over as commander-in-chief. Prior to that, by the way, in the general election in June 16th, pro-treaty Sinn Féin won 58 seats. 36 for the anti-treaty Sinn Féin, with Labour 17, Farmers 7, Independents 10, and so forth. And incidents are beginning to happen throughout the country. Arthur Griffith dies on the 12th of August. He, of course, was a proponent of the new treaty. And from there on, really, James, it's downhill in terms...
Once Michael Collins is killed, things really get bad then. You know, we're back to guerrilla warfare. And then in October, then there comes the execution policy of any men captured under arms are liable to be executed.
Yeah, in October, hundreds of prisoners are escaping from the Curra camp. Those would be anti-treatyites. And really, James, about these executions, in December, after a skirmish at Pike Bridge in Leixlip, an anti-treaty IRA column consisting of 22 men under Patrick Mullany was captured. The Irish Free State came into existence on the 6th of December, that month, Saoirstáit Éireann, as it was called. And then, tell me a little about National Army troops arresting 10 members of the Rathbride column, which led to a number of executions.
Yeah, these were arrested in a dugout. And if you go over to the February photograph, that's Annie Moore. And she was the one woman, she was a member of Cumann na mBan, and she was there as well, and she had a pistol when she was arrested. There was 10 members of the Rathbride column who were operating against the National Army in that area. And 7 of these were executed by firing squad in the Glasshouse Military Prison, the detention centre, where the Rangers Army Ring train now. And this was the grounds of that. They were executed and buried there.
Was there 5 more of that Mullany column executed in the following January of 23 because they had deserted from the Free State Army to join the anti-treaty IRA?
Yeah, they were executed in Dublin. 2 of them were actually from County Kildare. And that brings Kildare as one of the counties with the highest number of people executed during the Civil War, 9 in total from the county.
But James, what's utterly tragic about this is you had one side, the Free State Army, executing men on the other side, now the anti-treaty IRA, who had fought shoulder to shoulder against the British.
Yes, former comrades. Like, actually, the guys that are captured at the Mullany Column are captured by one of the officers in charge is Joseph Ledwidge, who had been one of the Minute 15 who had marched to Minute in 1916 to take part in the Rising. And he's one of the officers in command of the National Army who captured the Mullany Column. And for some of his former comrades, some of the guys that had walked with him from Minute are some of the lads that he captures at Pike's Bridge.
And we had orders for executions being handed down by the top brass. You know, in one case, Minister Kevin O'Higgins, you might correct me if I'm wrong in this, he was Minister for Justice. He was later shot dead by the IRA in 1927. But at one stage during the Civil War, he ordered the execution of the man who had been best man at his wedding.
Yes, Rory O'Connor, who
occupied the forecourts.
Who had occupied the forecourts. And if you were looking at, technically, like, those arrested under arms were liable to execution, but Rory O'Connor was captured in April when this didn't apply. So actually executing Rory O'Connor and the three others at the time was, illegal.
It was quite remarkable that he would order the execution of somebody who was obviously his best friend and who had been best man at his wedding. Isn't it just so ironic and tragic that aside from these former comrades executing each other, that Michael Collins and the Free State Army used British artillery to bomb the forecourts after it had been taken over by Rory O'Connor?
Of course, but they had no artillery of their own and they were armed by the British Army. They got all their rifles, all their ammunition, their artillery, their armoured cars, all came from the British side and that.
Who apparently put pressure on the Irish, either deal with this now or we'll reoccupy or whatever else came down.
Yeah, it'll be war again. And it was the same with when Lieutenant Wogan Brown was killed in Kildare in February, and this halted the evacuations of British troops from the country. Winston Churchill demanded that Michael Collins do something about it. And all these little attacks were adding up to what was then the occupation of the forecourts and another government.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the photographs that's most poignant in it is the photographs of the coffins at the funeral in the church, of the funerals of those seven of the Rathbride Column who were executed by firing squad in the Glasshouse military prison of the Curragh Camp on the 19th of December 2022.
But that photograph was taken in the former courthouse in Kildare, where on Saturday we had an exhibition of Garda memorabilia in the courthouse, and they said very few people were in that courthouse prior to that day on Saturday, but that photograph was taken there.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it was at the Civil War was as incidents of such savagery took place, summary executions of men on both sides, by both sides, and then appalling incidents like Ballyseedy and Kerry when Free State soldiers tied bombs or mines to the legs of anti-treatyites whom they had captured and blew them up. The kind of savagery is almost unconscionable, James.
Oh, yeah, it's hard to believe that we would actually do that to one another after, as you say, former comrades fighting together, and then the savagery that comes into it when some of their own men are killed, what do they actually do? And again, just going back to that courthouse incident too as well, the reason the seven coffins were displayed in the courthouse was because the parish priest wouldn't allow them into the local church for burial, because the bodies were handed over a year after the Civil War was over in October of 1924, and they were reinterred then in